If you want to get your Bibles and turn to John chapter 21, if you're already in chapter 20, we're going to be studying from that chapter this morning. A couple of months ago, one of our meetings that the elders and I had, there was one made a request that I do some lessons in the future on elders and shepherds and the role that they have and the congregation as sheep and such. And so probably this is kind of a little bit of an introductory lesson to that, more or less. And then we'll talk in a couple of weeks when I have a double Sunday to preach, or kind of a Sunday morning and Sunday night, on a little bit more extensively on the topic of shepherding. And we'll do that. We'll talk about this topic with a view to the idea of looking at this congregation and the young men who are here and the men who might serve one day as leaders in this congregation, and for us to think about the nature of the work and the kind of qualifications that would be necessary to achieve that work. And appreciate the elders' foresight on that, and so you can look forward to that in the next few weeks. But this morning I just wanted us to look at John chapter 21. It really is an interesting chapter because it's kind of strangely placed at the end of the chapter 20, where we just had the scripture reading. John sort of concludes his book almost by giving us the theme of what he's been saying all along. He finishes this book in a way, it seems like, saying that Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. So he explains his purpose of writing the book. If that's his purpose, then why go on to record another incident after that? And I think the answer, at least one answer to that, is what would one who has received Jesus as the Son of God and has gained life in his name do? What should he do? What should our response be to believing? And I think this last chapter sort of illustrates what he expected his disciples to get busy doing. And so what I want us to do is just go through this text. Look at this. It was a great chapter. And read through it and talk about a couple of the lessons that are there for today. And you'll notice some references to even shepherding as we get near the end. So let's begin our reading in verse 1. And let's read verse 1 through 3. John 21. I don't have any PowerPoints because I want your faces looking down. You should know this text. No reason to put the text on the PowerPoint. And stay with me. After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. And in this way, he showed himself: Simon Peter, Thomas called Didymus, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, "I am going fishing." And they said to him, "We are going with you also." And they went out and immediately got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. It says, after these things, in verse 1, probably after the previous resurrection appearances that he had recorded in chapter 20. After these things, Jesus manifested himself to his disciples. He lists seven of them that were together. And Peter, who is usually the outspoken one of the apostles, said in verse 3, "I am going fishing." People have raised the question about that numerous times. You know, was Peter abandoning his faith? Was he leaving Jesus and deciding to go fishing, back to his former occupation of fishing? Well, I would suggest a better explanation that he's leaving the Lord is that he's finding something to do with himself while he waits for the Lord to appear there. Jesus had told the disciples to go ahead of him into Galilee and he would join them there. And Peter and the apostles have gone to Galilee and they're waiting. Well, Peter's an active man. Peter likes to fish. I'm going to fish. And he goes out and takes the lead and gets in the boat, and the others say, "We're going to come too." And so he goes fishing, and that night, it says, they caught nothing. But, verse 4, let's read a little bit further. When the morning had now come, Jesus stood on the shore. Yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. And then Jesus said to them, "Boys, have you any food?" And he said to them, "Cast out your net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some." So they cast, and now they were not able to draw it in because of the multitude of fish. It's interesting that he notes here that Jesus is on the shore. He speaks to them, but they don't recognize him. They don't know it's Jesus. Perhaps because it was early morning. Perhaps it was the twilight, and they couldn't make out clearly the figure that was on the shore. Later it will tell us that they were about 200 cubits from the shore, which is about 100 yards. And he raises this question for them. You might just try to imagine this figure on the shore, and you're 100 yards out in a boat, and he shouts out to you. And he says, "You don't have any fish, do you?" Or as the New King James Version puts it, "Boys, have you any food?" I have different kind of renderings of that depending on the text. But the answer comes back, and probably was kind of an embarrassing answer if you think about it. You're these professional fishermen, and you fished all night. They say, no, been all out all night, and you've caught nothing. Maybe John remembers the statement that Jesus made back in chapter 15 and verse 5 when he said to them, "Without me, you can do nothing." So, he tells them, "Cast your net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some." If you remember correctly, that was one of the first miracles that Jesus ever worked with his disciples when he called them. Luke chapter 5, verse 1 through 11, he had sent them out in the boat, or they had gone out fishing, and they had no luck fishing, and he said, "Have you caught anything?" And they said, "Nothing." So in a sense, Jesus is recreating for these men a lesson that he had taught them before. And he's reminding them here of how important it is to follow his directions. That because even though they had caught nothing, at his word, they would have a great catch. You see that? And so it says in verse 7, "Therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved," they did what Jesus said. They cast the nets out and they drew the net back, and they had so many fish that they caught a great multitude. It says, "Therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, 'It is the Lord.' And now, when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was wearing only an undergarment, and he plunged into the sea." When he says here at the beginning of verse 7, "that disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter," we recognize that that was the common way that John referred to himself in his gospel. And then it says, Simon Peter plunged into the sea. So he dove off the boat and started for shore because he wanted to get to Jesus. So, you know, you kind of have the characteristics of these two disciples in this action. You have John, who is a disciple who gains quick insight. He hears what Jesus says and he says, "That's the Lord." And you have Peter, who is the disciple who takes quick action. And they follow through with their characteristic responses here again. So it says here in verse 8, "And the other disciples came in a little boat, for they were not far from land, but about 200 cubits, dragging the net with fish. And as soon as they had come to land, they saw a fire of coals there, and the fish laid on it, and the bread. And Jesus said to them, 'Bring some of the fish which you have just caught.'" So in verse 8, the rest of the disciples come. They come in their boats. They bring the boat. And, because they're not far from land, but maybe 200 cubits, And they're dragging the net with the fish. And as soon as they come to land, they see a fire. And it's a fire made by coals. Now, you might just read right over that and not pay any attention to that detail. But I would call your attention to that just for a second. That they saw a fire of coals and a fish laid on it and bread. It's kind of significant because the only other reference to a charcoal fire in the New Testament is just a couple of pages back in chapter 18 and verse 18. So if you want to just glance at that for a half a second. Whenever Jesus had been arrested and taken in, Peter found himself standing with some others outside in the priest's courtyard, and it says the servants and officers who had made a fire of coals stood there, for it was cold, and they warmed themselves, and Peter stood with them and warmed himself. That the only other time that charcoal fire is mentioned is when Peter gathered around a charcoal fire in the priest's courtyard, and at that time he denies his Lord three times. Here you notice that Jesus already has some fish and some bread. He had apparently picked up breakfast on the way. And he serves them. So once again, even at the end, even after Jesus is raised from the dead, he is serving his disciples and providing for their needs. And it says that he said to them, remember, going back to chapter 21 again, Jesus says in verse 10, bring some of the fish which you have just caught. Now, we might suppose that Jesus would have just multiplied those loaves and fishes. You know, there's only seven disciples there, and he's already done it with 5,000 and 4,000. Certainly that wouldn't have been a problem. But he does what is more typical. He uses what the disciples bring him as well as what he provides. Normally, Jesus does that with us. He'll use what we bring to the table as well as what he provides. And so verse 11, Simon Peter went up and dragged the net to the land full of large fish, 153. Although there were so many, the net was not broken. It's 153 fish. If I'd given you a quiz about this chapter, and I'd ask you to tell some different facts you remember, you probably could have come up with a few of them. I could have. But would you have been able to name how many fish that they caught that day? I don't think I could have come up with that number. And I'll tell you what. When I looked at it, there were at least 153 explanations about why he said there were 153 fish that they caught. And they all are just about symbolic, in some kind of symbolic fashion. Well, obviously, he caught a lot of fish. And that may just be the point that he's making here. That, you know, serious fishermen, they can pretty much tell you how many fish that they caught. I can tell you, whenever I go fishing, I come back and I know how many fish I caught that day. John knew how many there were, and there was a large number of them. It was an amazing miracle that Jesus performed, because they fished all night and caught nothing. And at Jesus' word, they dropped their nets in the water, and they caught 153 fish. And Jesus said to them in verse 12, looking down again at your Bibles, in verse 12, it says, and Jesus said to them, come and eat breakfast. And yet none of the disciples dared ask him, who are you, knowing that it was the Lord. I think that's an interesting statement that John makes there. You know, couldn't they have recognized him? I mean, he was standing there staring them right in the face. Perhaps there were some changes that had accompanied Jesus' resurrection that made them unsure. Or perhaps not. Perhaps it was from the beatings that he had normally killed most people prior to the time that he was crucified. Usually we think of the scarred hands and the pierced side as the only marks that would have gone with Jesus' crucifixion. But that would certainly not have been the only marks that he would have borne. And so perhaps That's why they couldn't recognize him at first. But it says, none of them dared to ask, who are you? For they knew it was the Lord. How would they have known that? Well, number one is he duplicated a miracle for them that he had done before. And number two, he said things to them that he had said before. And so they knew it was the Lord. Well, it says in verse 13 that Jesus then came and took the bread and gave it to them, and likewise the fish. Now, this is the third time Jesus showed himself to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. It says that Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and likewise the fish. Some people suggest that this is kind of like a covenant meal that Jesus was providing here. That in providing them this fish and this bread, he was extending provisions for them. He was showing his acceptance of them. He certainly had indicated that he had forgiven them for their denial of him, and that he was guaranteeing an ongoing relationship, sort of like covenant meals in the Old Testament expressed that. Perhaps that's involved here. I don't know. John doesn't make any reference to it, doesn't give any attention to it. But at least it's a picture of friendship, intimate friendship between him and his disciples. And it says this is the third time that Jesus had showed himself to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. This is the third time in John's gospel that he records Jesus' encounter with his disciples. If you look back in chapter 20, there's two places where he encountered his disciples already. So far, if we stop here in this reading, so far Jesus has reminded his disciples of important lessons that he had already taught them. Number one, that without him, they can do nothing. Isn't that a lesson that we need to learn as well? I'll mention that again at the end. But he had emphasized that in the book of John, back in chapter 6, when he fed the 5,000. And he said to the disciples, he said, you feed them. How much will it take to feed these people? And they sat and calculated. They went through their mind and they calculated how much it would take to feed these people. And they said, there's not even enough. There's nowhere close to what we need to feed these people. And I believe it was only then when they came to understand that in themselves they could not do anything to resolve that situation that they were ready for Jesus to work his miracle. And then later he emphasized that in chapter 15, without me you can do nothing. And then here again at the very end, they go out fishing, they come back with nothing, and he resolves the situation for them. Without me you can do nothing. The second thing is that he had taught them before, is that it is important to obey his commands. And when they did that, they would see amazing things happen. He said, put down your net on the side of the boat and you will get a great catch. And when they did what he said, in spite of the fact that they were professional fishermen, they had fished all night long and they had caught nothing, at his bidding, when they did what he said, he did an amazing thing through them. And then the third one that I want you to notice, that lesson he taught, is that his ability to provide for multitudes through them. He provided for many through these people. And so, but you know what? When you get to this point in this chapter, this is really only the background for the teaching that follows. John's kind of notable for this. He'll record a miracle, and then he'll provide the teaching. That's the sequence that John uses. And so I want us to look a little bit further and finish this chapter here in chapter 21. Beginning in verse 15. And he directs his comments to one particular disciple. It says, so when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said, feed my lambs. When he speaks after breakfast, he speaks directly to Simon Peter. And wouldn't you know that Simon's ears, he picks up his ears on this one. Because he calls him by his full name. Simon, son of John, or Simon, son of Jonah, it says in the New King James Version. You know, he only called Peter by his full name at very important events in his life. taught him that at the very beginning when he called Peter to be his disciple. The second time, maybe I'd ask you the question, can you remember? There's one time that we usually remember when he said that. It's when he asked him, who do people say that I am? And then Peter says, thou art the Christ. And he says, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, or Simon son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you. And then this is the third time that he has called Peter by his full name. So when Jesus said, Simon son of Jonah, he realized something important is about to come. You ever hear your mother call you that? Yeah, your dad never says that to you, never calls you by your full name. But your mom will do that. And when she says that, you know you're in trouble, or there's something that's important that's about to be said. And so he says, Simon, son of Jonas. And Peter, paying attention. And he says, do you love me more than these? More than what? More than these what? More than these fish? More than these nets? More than these boats? I think that Jesus meant more than these other disciples. You remember what Peter said just a couple of nights before? That he had said, though all forsake you, you can count on me. I will never forsake you. So I wonder, you know, when he says, do you love me more than these? Do you still have this sort of proud estimation of your devotion to me? And Peter's response was, Lord, yes, Lord, you know that I do. And Jesus said, feed my lambs. Take care of the young of my flock, Peter. Many people point out, when you get to this passage, that Jesus used a very strong word for love in the first two questions that he asked Peter. He used the word agapo, or agapao. And that refers to a love that's a very strong commitment. He's saying, Peter, are you totally committed to me? But Peter's response, he couldn't bring himself to use the same word when he spoke back to Jesus. Instead, he used a different word for love, phileo, which means strong affection. And so he says, you know, I have a strong affection for you. I mean, after all, how could he say, I have a totally devoted, committed love, when he had denied him three times? But in spite of his weak response, Jesus gives him a commission. He says to him, feed my lambs. You ever think about that? At first, when Jesus first talked to Peter, he told him that he would be a fisher of men. He told him that he would catch fish. Which, I guess I'd always say that come as an evangelistic word, going out and preaching the gospel to others. But now he calls him to be a shepherd. Tend my sheep. And so it's interesting that in chapter 5 of 1 Peter, later in the New Testament, near the end of the New Testament period, that Peter would call himself a pastor or a shepherd. So eventually he did grow into that work. But then Jesus said to him a second time in verse 16, he said to him a second time, do you love me? He said, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said, tend my sheep. And again, you have those two different words for love. And he uses the word, if you have a different translation, he says, shepherd my sheep. And John is notable for using synonyms in his gospel. So when he says, feed my lambs, or shepherd my sheep, or tend my sheep, I take that to be all equivalent terms that he's saying to Peter. And then he says to him a third time in verse 17. He says, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? And Peter was grieved because he said to him a third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. And Jesus said, feed my sheep. This time, interestingly, Jesus used Peter's weaker word for love. Peter, do you have a strong affection for me? Peter couldn't bring himself to say he was totally committed to Jesus, so Jesus used that weaker word as well. And it says that Peter was grieved because he said to him a third time, do you love me? He wasn't grieved because he used the weaker word. He was grieved because Jesus said it to him three times, do you love me? Maybe it reminded him maybe of that three-time denial, the three times that he said he didn't know who Jesus was just a few days before. And then he says to him in verse 18, "Most assuredly, I say to you, when you were younger, you girded yourself and walked where you wished. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish." And then he says, "This he spoke, signifying by what death he would glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, 'Follow me.'" The phrase, "stretch out your hands," many extra-biblical sources say that that was a euphemism for crucifixion. But he tells Peter that the time will come when he will be a prisoner, when he will be taken against his will, and he will go where he does not want to go. And according to tradition, that's what happened to Peter, that he was crucified around 68 A.D. But he's saying to him, "You really need a deeper kind of love for me than the kind of love that you've shown thus far." And when he spoke that to Peter, he says, "Follow me." That was the first words that Mark's gospel records that Jesus said to Peter. And they're the last words that Jesus records, or John records, that he said to Peter. Peter would follow Jesus even all the way to death. He kind of challenges Peter here, I think, with the kind of job that lies before him, and that he is going to have to rise and increase his love to meet that challenge, to be able to do what Jesus had planned for him to do. Peter's response to that is kind of true to life. Peter turns around in verse 20, and he saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following, who also had leaned on his chest at the supper, and who had said, "Lord, who is the one who betrays you?" And Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, "Lord, and what will this man do?" So Peter learns of God's will for him, and now he wants to know what God's will is for John. And isn't that the way we tend to be? We are so interested in God's will for other people. And Jesus responds to him, and he says in verse 22, "If I will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me." And that's "you" there is singular, and it's emphatic. "You follow me." So, Peter, you don't worry about what about other believers. And what I'll do with them. You concentrate on following me. You do what I have in mind for you. You know, our success as Jesus' servants depends on our love for him. Where is my love? Is it at the phileo level, the affectionate kind of level? Is it at the total commitment and total devotion level yet? So my success as a disciple of his depends somewhat on the amount of the kind of love I have for him, but it depends even more on how much we appreciate his love for us. We love him, John will say later, because he first loved us. So I think only when I really appreciate the degree of love that Jesus has for me will it prompt me to raise my game, to move from maybe a lower form of love to a higher form of love. Probably I would think that when we read this chapter that there should be questions in your mind. What is God's will for me? What is his will for me? And, I don't know in particular. I haven't really got to worry about that, do I? He would tell me, "You just worry about what you've got to do. You worry about what Mike Bozeman needs to do it, and you let me deal with everybody else and what they're supposed to do." But there are some good lessons in this, I think, for us as well as for the disciples then. Number one is that without him, we can do nothing. Without him, we can do nothing. That's a practical lesson. And the sooner I get that self-reliant, self-confident attitude away from me, and that dependence on me, the sooner God can do more with me. Because he says without him, we can do nothing. The second thing is, it's important to obey his commands. No matter what I think, no matter what my wisdom tells me, if he says, throw the net over the boat and you'll catch something, you'll get a big catch, I need to trust his word and do what he says. That's an objective faith. It means it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter whether it fits into my professional opinion about things. Peter was a professional, but he put that aside and did what the Lord said, and the result was that he had a great catch. And number three is when we do that, when we do what God says, we will see amazing things happen. You know what? He doesn't have to work miracles today, but he does things that are far more impressive than just miracles. He can help us save souls. When we do what he says and we take his word and we share it with others, we plant the seed in his heart, then he does greater things than parting a Red Sea. Raising someone from the dead physically. He raises people from the dead spiritually. He will do great things if we'll learn to trust him and to do what he says. And his ability to provide even through multitudes through us is there in the story as well. But I'll tell you the last thing I thought about too, and that is that we need to prepare ourselves for greater works of service still. He told Peter, tend my sheep. We may be doing what we can where we are, and going out and sowing the seed or whatever. But he has other things that he would like to achieve with us too. And we need to prepare ourselves for greater works still. And he set before Peter not only the task of catching fish, but there would be a day that would come when Peter would be ready to shepherd and attend his sheep. And he would be an elder. And we need to look at that too. Right now we may see ourselves where we are in our life, and we know what we can do, and I would assume are doing what we can do with the abilities that we have now. But the Lord looks beyond that to maturity, into a time when he has other works that he can do with us if we will put our faith in him and begin now preparing ourselves for those greater works in the future. So let this be something to prompt you to prepare yourself for the works of service that God has for you in the future. In a couple of weeks, like I said, we're going to do a couple more lessons that involves the work of a shepherd and with a view of men here growing toward that role. So this morning, what's God's will for you? Well, if you're not a Christian, God's will is that you, or if you are a Christian, God's will is that you grow up into all things in his Son. That's what his will is. Ephesians chapter 4, that we grow up and become more like his Son. If you're not a Christian, we need to leave what you're doing and follow him. You need to leave what you're doing. That's what he did when he came to Peter and the other disciples at the very early stages. He said, leave what you're doing and follow me. And so a great test of whether we'll be followers of Jesus is whether we'll leave the things of this world, leave the things that are important to us maybe behind, refocus our priorities and our hearts, and begin to walk after him. This morning, if you would do that, become a Christian, you need to take the initial steps that he said. You got to believe in him. You see him as the good shepherd. You see him as the Christ, the Son of God. You got to trust and believe in that. And then you have to submit to him. Those are enormous things that we will work our entire lives to fully learn.